Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday morning. Each weekday afternoon. I'm on for a half hour every weekday morning and an hour every weekday afternoon on various stations and on the internet. Some of you are listening by way of our internet stream, perhaps listening through our app. There's the narrowpath.com app for iPhones, and there's also one for Android somewhere out there. I'm not really sure where to find that. I know you can get the iPhone one from the App Store, and it's free, and it makes you able to listen to our programs live or later from your phone anytime you want to. But if you're listening now while we're live, that means you have opportunity to participate in the program while it's being made, and you can call with questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith. Or you can call with differences of opinion from the host that you want to talk about. You can call this number. It's 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our first caller today is Richard, calling from Phoenix, Arizona. Richard, a regular caller. Hi, Richard. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. Hi. Thanks for taking my call today.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I wanted to revisit this question of the dispensationalist view that Jesus cannot be on the throne of David based upon Revelation 3:21, which says he sits on his father's throne. It seems to me as though they are seeing this in some kind of a strange, literal, locative sense, as if Jesus can't be on both thrones at the same time, which I find to be very strange, since I would think Jesus would be everywhere, and there's no place he isn't. And so I'm wondering what this is. Is this? I know you've said before to me that to sit on the throne of David is not terminology of a literal throne or chair or seat, but that it means to sit in authority as king over the same kingdom that David once ruled or occupied.
Right.
And so, seeing that that's true, and that the throne is symbolic of royal authority, is this, these things we're seeing in heaven, are they anthropomorphisms? And if they are, what are they intending to teach us and to show us, besides this real literal construct, this locational thing that they're drumming up?
Well, you're talking about Revelation chapters 4 and 5 when you say these things we see in heaven?
No, I'm talking about the dispensational view of Revelation 3:21, where the overcomer is said that he will sit on Jesus' throne. Jesus says that, and he says, just as I have sat on my father's throne, and the dispensationalists say, well, see, he can't be sitting on David's throne if he's sitting on his father's throne, which I take to mean from them that they're using it in a locative sense. He can't be on, you know, the throne
right,
of David.
Right, I understand that. I understand that. You're asking about anthropomorphisms. Most of our vision of heaven in Revelation is in chapters 4 and 5. He does make an allusion to sitting on his father's throne in chapter 3, but we don't actually ever see him there. But, I mean, that doesn't mean it's not where he really is, but when we actually see a vision of heaven, we see God on the throne, and we don't see Jesus on the throne with him. We see a lamb, Jesus, coming up to the throne and receiving from him who sits on the throne a scroll with seven seals. So we never actually see Jesus sitting on his father's throne, though he does say in chapter 3 and verse 21 that he is seated on his father's throne, which means that what he says there doesn't even necessarily agree in detail with what is depicted in the heavenly scene in chapters 4 and 5. But that shouldn't bother us, because in many cases, I mean, unless we are taking these images very literally, and I'm sure many people are inclined to do so, but I don't see any need to do so, unless we're taking them very literally, they can all be true in terms of the point they're trying to make. Jesus, when he said he's seated on his father's throne with him, I believe it means that he's been elevated to sit on the throne that rules over the earth, and that would include reigning over Israel. So it'd be like David's throne, which is the reign over Israel, would be a subset of the father's throne. It wouldn't be a different seat, but David's throne was the throne of God's kingdom, Israel. And therefore, I mean, it would not have been, it's not done to my knowledge, but it would not have been out of line to refer to David's throne as the throne of God, the throne of God's kingdom, because David was seated on his father's throne, as it were,
right,
ruling over Israel. Now, David didn't sit on a chair where God was sitting next to him in the same chair or something like that. But we can say that God was ruling over Israel, and David was ruling over Israel with him. Therefore, we could say that David was seated with God in the throne position. That would simply mean they share, each of them, a role in the sovereignty over Israel. God, of course, much above David, but David still raised up to sit in that position in the throne over the kingdom that God reigned. So reigning with God, as it were, can be depicted as sitting in a throne with God. We don't know of there ever being a throne on earth, or for that matter necessarily in heaven, which could accommodate two persons side by side. But Jesus said he is seated with his Father in his throne. But then he also said we, and that's millions of us, will sit with him in his throne. Well, how big is this throne? And is that really what we're going to be doing? You know, millions of us lined up with our legs hanging over the edge of the cushion of the seat? And, you know, or is he just saying, is this an image for reigning with him, sharing in his reign? That he sits on his Father's throne with him is an image for sharing with his Father in the in his reign, just as David shared with God in his reign over Israel. And we will sit with Christ in his throne, needn't be taken very literally. I mean, in some cases, for example, in Revelation 20, the image is changed completely. Those who have been beheaded for Christ are seen on thrones, plural. You know, I saw thrones and those who sat on them. So, you know, we change the imagery in Revelation 20. You've got believers who've died and gone to heaven, and they're sitting on thrones, presumably one each. But there's millions of them. So, I mean, if you can picture millions of little chairs with people on them, and, you know, if that's how we're supposed to understand it, well, so be it. But I don't know that that's really the image we're supposed to have. The idea of sitting on a throne means ruling. And so even picturing Jesus sitting on the same chair next to God, although that's the language he uses, it's the imagery. The question is, what does the imagery mean? And so my understanding is that Jesus reigns with his Father, and that's what it means that he sits with his Father on his throne. We will reign with Christ, which is simply what is meant by we will sit with him on his throne. David reigned with God over Israel, which means that sitting on the Father's throne is analogous to David's throne. So Jesus sitting on the throne at the right hand of God would be comparable to where David sat. It'd be like him sitting on David's throne in his position.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I think that the dispensationalists, the only way I can figure out what they're trying to say is they're trying to say that if Jesus is occupying his Father's throne, then he can't be on two thrones at the same time. That's really what they're saying, because
right, but they're being quite literal about the throne thing, you know.
Yeah,
and
they are.
And
but
I've
even
said,
in
our previous conversations, you know, Solomon is said to have sat on David's throne, but he didn't sit on the same chair that David sat on. The Bible tells that Solomon made his own throne, much larger and more elaborate than David's. He got rid of David's old chair and made his own. But because he was reigning over the same kingdom as David, it's still called the throne of David.
Yeah, exactly.
Different chair, same position, yeah.
Okay, and in 321, and I just want to say this one thing, and I'll let you go to your next caller, and that is it says, if you look at it closely, their estimation of this verse defeats what they're saying, because it's Christ says, to him who overcomes, I will grant him to sit with me on my throne. Well, how can he promise the overcomer to sit with him on his own throne if he's preoccupied on his Father's throne? That doesn't make any sense.
Well, I think probably what they would say about that is that during this present age, Jesus hasn't received his own throne yet, but he's sharing the throne with his Father. But then in probably they would say in the millennial kingdom, Jesus will have his own throne there. However, Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15 that Christ will reign until he's put all his enemies under his feet, and then he'll give up the kingdom to his Father, or he'll turn it over to the Father. Which sounds like rather than Jesus getting his own throne, he's going to be giving the one he has to his Father. So, I mean, all the imagery,
right.
We have to be careful not to try to, you know, make all this imagery all work in a literal way.
Right.
For example, in Revelation chapter 1, Jesus is seen having seven stars in his right hand. Well, a few verses later, he puts his hand on John's head and stands him up when he's fallen down. So what happened to the stars in his hands? Did the stars fall out, or did he, did they press up against John's head? Or what? I mean, the imagery of Jesus holding the stars in his hand is simply getting across an idea. These are the seven angels, the seven churches, and Christ, commands them and controls them in his hand. Likewise, putting his hand on John's head is something that's probably more figurative than literal, too. Although if it is literal, then the stars probably were not. Well, they're not, because the stars represent angels, not stars. So, I mean, with all this imagery in the book of Revelation, anyone who's trying to press if somebody tried to make an animated movie of this whole book, and I think it's probably been done. I don't know. I haven't seen it. I'm not going to go looking for one. But it seems like they'd have a hard time keeping all the visuals correct, because, it's just, for instance, the 24 elders, they fall down continually day and night praising God and casting their crowns before the throne. Well, okay, so they are eternally casting their crowns before the throne. How would you depict that? You could show them throwing them down, but how do they keep doing it forever and ever and ever? They have to pick them back up again and put them down and pick them up and put them down. The ideas are impressionistic. They're not literal.
Okay, so that's what you're saying about that gives me the answer that I'm looking for, I think, because what you're saying is the thrones are impressionistic. They're teaching us ideas about Christ's reign, his rule, his sovereignty, the Father's sovereignty. They're not to be taken literally, like there's actual chairs, and he's got one chair to sit on that's his own, another one that he has to get up from and go to sit on his Father's throne and stuff like that.
And he's got to have one for himself that's big enough to put millions of Christians on with him. I mean, he could. I mean, I'm not saying this is impossible. I'm just saying it's not really reasonable. I mean, it's not reasonable to assume that this is what it's supposed to communicate to us. Yeah.
Yeah, and one more thing: if he's the high priest who is asking us to come boldly before the throne of grace, then if he's preoccupied on one throne, that means for 2,000 years nobody would be able to approach him with their needs, because he's occupied on one throne and he can't come to the throne of grace.
Well, yeah, okay. unless the one throne he's on is also called the throne of grace additionally. But, it's not necessary to harmonize all these things in terms of, like I said, a graphic image. It's certainly, the language is very graphic to get across ideas, but the imagery changes from one scene to the next.
Right.
Because, to make a different point, the graphics are altered. Anyway.
All right, great answer. Thank you very much.
Okay, Richard, good talking to you. Thank you for your call.
Yeah, good talking to you. Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right, God bless you. All right, we're going to talk next to Fred from Henderson, Nevada. Fred, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me, Steve. I appreciate all your work. My question is about the Antichrist.
Uh-huh.
Is it true that the early Protestants believed that the Antichrist was from the papal? I mean,
yes,
it says specifically in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4, and from the book of Daniel, that it sounds like it's the papal, and that they're the ones that created a man Antichrist to kind of direct things away from the papals. Do you concur with that?
Well, that is historically correct. It is historically correct that the papal institution, or the popes as an institution, the reformers, and many men before the Reformation, including Wycliffe and Tyndale and Huss, and even certain monastics like the Franciscans, they believed that the papal institution was the man of sin. And this didn't change among Protestants until the 1800s. So in the 1800s, another view was adopted by many Protestants, and that was the view that the man of sin is actually individual man who will arise in the last days and be called the Antichrist. This is, since we were all born since then, many people have always assumed that that's, the only way to understand 2 Thessalonians 2. But it's a rather new way of looking at it from a Protestant point of view. Now, I say that because, of course, the idea that the Antichrist is a single individual was popularized by the Counter-Reformation. After Luther's time, within less than a century, the Roman Catholics were putting forward the idea that the Antichrist, or the man of sin, is not an institution like the papal institution, but is actually an individual man who will rise in the last days. So this idea of this individual Antichrist replaced the Reformed view in the minds of the Roman Catholics as early as the 1590s. But it wasn't until the early 1800s, so at least 200-something years afterwards, that the first Protestant accepted this Catholic idea. So the Protestant view up till about the beginning of the 20th century was essentially the idea that the papal institution, the popes, were the man of sin. But before the end of that century, before the end of the 19th century, was introduced the alternative view into the Protestant circles that the Catholics had come up with themselves, that the popes are not the Antichrist, but the Antichrist is a future political dictator.
Well, that certainly answers that. I appreciate that, and I agree with the initial belief. It seems very obvious to me in Scripture, especially in Daniel.
Yeah, Daniel chapter 7 you're talking about, where after the fourth beast, Rome,
yes,
falls, you've got this little horn that's boasting and blaspheming and persecuting the saints, and that certainly is, the fourth beast was Rome, and when the Roman Empire fell, the papal institution did rise up and do all those things that Daniel said, and all the church fathers believed that when Paul in 2 Thessalonians 2 spoke of the man of lawlessness, they believed he was talking about Daniel chapter 7 and the little horn. So if they are correct, then, you know, Paul and Daniel are both talking about something that would rise on the downfall of the Roman Empire. Now, remember in 2 Thessalonians 2, Paul said there was something in his own day that was preventing the rise of the man of lawlessness. He did not say what it was, but he said that that thing had to be removed before he could rise. But when that is taken out of the way, then the man of sin will rise. Well, the church fathers believed that Paul was referring to the fourth beast, the Roman Empire, was preventing the man of sin from rising. And quite a large number of the church fathers predicted that when the Roman Empire would fall, which it did not in their time, but it did later than their time. But they predicted in the early church writings that when the Roman Empire would be taken out of the way, that's when the man of sin would rise. Now, the interesting thing is that Paul didn't clearly identify what it was that was hindering the man of sin. But their view was that Paul didn't do that because he was, in fact, talking about the removal of the Roman Empire. And writing to the Thessalonians, you might remember that Paul had spent 3 weeks in Thessalonica and been run out of town by the locals because they said he was teaching things that were contrary to Caesar, saying that there's another king, one Jesus. So he had actually been run out of town in Thessalonica on the charge that he's writing things that were subversive against the Roman Empire. So if he, in fact, was referring to the removal of the Roman Empire as a necessity, he would not necessarily want that to be stated so clearly that, you know, hostile hands who might receive that letter could say, see, this confirms it. He's talking about the overthrow of Rome, you know. So, I mean, he would, in that case, have reason to be somewhat obscure in his statements. And he was obscure.
Very good. That answers my question entirely. And, of course, the son of perdition who opposes and exalts himself above all is called God. And is that worship? It certainly points in that direction.
Well, and there's one other thing, too. Paul specifically said the man of sin will sit in the temple of God and declare himself to be God. Well, what is the temple of God as far as Paul's concerned? The expression temple of God appears two other times in Paul's writings, once in 1 Corinthians and once in 2 Corinthians. In 1 Corinthians, he says to the church in chapter 3, do you not know that you, the church, are the temple of God? And he says the same thing in 2 Corinthians chapter 6. He says, you are the temple of God, the church is. So Paul uses the phrase the temple of God as a reference to the church, and he never, to our knowledge, has ever used it in the Bible. He never used it to speak of a Jewish temple, but the spiritual temple, the real church of God, the real temple of God. And so when he says the man of sin will sit in the temple of God, Paul's using an expression that he's already used you know, we have two other instances of him using it. And in those places, he identifies what he means. It's in the church. So the man of sin doesn't sit in a Jewish temple. He sits in the church. And that certainly is where the papal institution arose. And as far as claiming that he's God, how many times did Jesus, you know, tell us not to call people father or things like that, because we have only one father? That's God. Well, the popes call themselves father. That's taking a title that Jesus said belonged only to God. The Holy Father, you know, I mean, good heavens. Jesus referred, when Jesus was praying to his father, he said, Holy Father. He called God Holy Father. Now, the Roman Catholic institution refers to the Pope by that title. Anyway, we don't have time to go into that more right now. I've got to take some more calls, but I want to make this clear. I'm not Catholic bashing, though I might be Pope bashing. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not 100% sure. I'm not 100% sure that the Reformers' view is correct, but it has an awful lot in its favor. Paul clearly is obscure, and therefore there is at least a possibility that there may be another view that fits the data as well as the Reformed view, but I'm not aware of one. But the point is, even if we conclude that Paul was talking about the rise of the papacy, it doesn't mean that he's talking about every Roman Catholic person. Certainly many Roman Catholic people are godly people, in my opinion, and have the Spirit of Christ, and throughout history there have been wonderful Roman Catholic Christians. But that doesn't mean that the organization they belong to is a holy institution, or that the leader, the Pope, is a real man of God. Anyway, that's obviously a very controversial thing in our time, because it's very politically incorrect to say things like that.
Yeah, but, exactly.
But it's historically accurate. I mean, that's what the Reformers all believed. And they had some pretty good arguments for it.
Right. Well, thank you. I appreciate it, Steve. That really clears things up. Thank you.
Okay, Fred. Thanks for your call.
Okay. Goodbye.
God bless you. Bye now. Okay. We're going to talk next to Randy from Sacramento, California. Randy, good to hear from you. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Thank you. I appreciate you calling. I have just one crazy question to ask you.
Good, a crazy one. Those are fun.
Yeah, this is a crazy one that I've pondered on for a very, very long time, and I haven't been able to quite figure it out. The scholars, the biblical scholars, say that the world has only been created for 6,000 years. But the scientists say that the world has been created for millions of years. And what I'm trying to figure out is I definitely believe I've been a Christian since I was 11 years old. And I definitely believe that it was only been a little over 6,000 years that the world's been created. But my question to you is where did the dinosaurs come from? If the planet was created and it's only been 6,000 years, and when it was created, it was Adam and Eve. So where did the dinosaurs come into effect?
Well, what were the dinosaurs? What larger category of beings do they belong to?
I don't understand you on that one.
Were they plants or animals?
Animals.
Okay. Well, when were the animals created?
At the beginning of time.
Well, I mean, on what day? What day of creation, though?
Well, that would be on the seventh day.
Or the sixth. The sixth day,
seventh day, God rested.
Right. So on the sixth day, God created all the land animals. And on the fifth day, the day before that, he created the arboreal animals, or the flying animals, and the aquatic animals, those in the sea. Now, among the animals that flew, there were some dinosaurs. Among the creatures in the sea, there were some dinosaurs. And among those creatures on the land, there were some dinosaurs too. And so we'd have to say that when God created all the things that fly, that would probably include the flying dinosaurs, since they would be among all the things that fly. And when it says he created everything that was in the sea, and it specifically says in Genesis 1, including the great sea monsters, specifically says that. The great sea monsters, that could be whales, but it could also include some pretty monstrous creatures that are known to have lived in the ancient world in the sea. And then, of course, the land animals on the day six, there are dinosaurs that were land animals, and so they would fit on that day.
Okay. All right. Well, that would make sense because it just puzzled me because I've never believed in scientists and, you know, and the Scientology and all that other stuff. But I was just puzzled the heck out of me is trying to figure out how, if God created Adam and Eve, how did man, you know, move around the Earth with dinosaurs on it on top of it? So that's why that's what was confusing me.
Well, I understand, and there's other things that probably contribute to that confusion, like the fact that we've been told that dinosaurs died out 70 billion years before man evolved. And therefore, on that view, men and dinosaurs never, you know, walked the earth together. But the statement that man and earth never walked, man and dinosaurs never walked on the earth together, is quite contrary to a large number of evidences of various kinds, including the fact that some ancient societies have built or created clay figurines that are of dinosaurs, or have carved on their temple pillars stone images of Stegosaurus, or have in caves painted pictures of Brontosaurus and so forth. I mean, there's an awful lot of evidence that ancient man saw dinosaurs, including most continents. You can find legends of heroes who killed what they called dragons. Of course, they didn't have the word dinosaur didn't exist until the 1800s. But before that time, there were creatures that were apparently reptilian that were called dragons. And there's quite a few legends, at least, of great heroes of societies on every continent that killed dragons, could well have been dinosaurs. We don't know, but we certainly can't deny that they were. And in the book of Job, one of the most ancient surviving books in the world, there are descriptions of dinosaurs. There's a creature called Leviathan. There's a creature called Behemoth. Both are described, and if we take the description seriously, they had to be dinosaurs. They were reptiles, and they're giant. And the word dinosaur just is a word from the Latin that means terrible lizard. And you know, if you take the description of Leviathan and the description of Behemoth from the book of Job, you're describing a terrible lizard, that's for sure. I mean, if the word existed back then, they would have called those dinosaurs. But they didn't have the word dinosaur yet. But they had the creatures, and they were familiar. And they could describe not only their looks, but their behavior. If you read in Job about that, you find that Job describes not only how fearsome and large and terrible these creatures were, but he also describes their behaviors. So they were actually creatures that were observed to actually live in that time. And you'll find that if you read the end of chapter 40 of Job, beginning at verse 15, Job 40, verse 15, to the end of that chapter, and then read on into chapter 41. You'll read about those creatures. Now you mentioned, well, how could man walk around on the earth with dinosaurs there? Well, I'll tell you the truth. I kind of wonder how human beings can live in jungles with tigers and with, you know, other horrible creatures, crocodiles that eat people when they go down to wash their clothes in the rivers and so forth. And, I mean, there's some pretty nasty creatures out there. And, frankly, a lot of people who've lived around them have died. But in many cases, people have tried to build their civilization somewhat further away from where these creatures are frequently seen, or have tried to kill off the creatures in the region where they lived. I'm sure that just as people have done that with carnivorous animals in modern times, they've either avoided their hunts or else killed off the ones where they were, or else they died. People do die sometimes still from tigers and lions and bears. You know, I'm sure that dinosaurs, which were also very large and dangerous creatures, no doubt, that they were also, you know, dealt with similarly. Probably people killed them when they could. And by the way, Job makes it very clear that it was impossible with the ancient weapons of his time. It was impossible to kill Leviathan. It said his scales on his belly were so thick that if you shoot arrows at them, the arrows will break like they're made of dried grass. So that's just how thick the scales were. So killing an adult carnivorous dinosaur might not have been a possibility, but for them to hunt down their nest and kill all their eggs, and then the adults eventually would die off and there'd be no babies, eventually you'd drive them extinct that way. And I would imagine if I were living back then, I'd probably try to do that. Anyway, I don't know if that's what happened. I'm not saying that I was, there or can say what happened, but I can picture scenarios where it would be not that much different. It'd be pretty awful living around raptors and other carnivorous dinosaurs, but it's pretty awful living around packs of wolves and bears and such too. I mean, people do have to share the world with some pretty nasty creatures or creatures that are awfully intimidating. And apparently there were some that are not around anymore that were very awful that people had to live around at one time or move away from.
Well, I want to thank you for answering my question, because I tell you, I've sat for many months pondering this, trying to figure this one out, and my pastor couldn't figure it out. So, and I listen to you I actually listen to your re-recording at 2:30 in the morning, because I work at night. I work nights.
Wow.
So I listen to your half-hour one. But I would just happen to be on the road, and I heard you going, so I called.
Well, I'm glad you called. Thanks, Randy.
Hey, thank you very much, and you have a great and fantastic day.
You too. God bless you. All right, we're going to talk next to, looks like it's Shay from Michigan. Shay, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm calling through my computer, so I don't know if I'm going to cut out or not. We've been listening to the show for a while, and I've got like a personal issue that I'd like to see if I can have you answer over the air, so I'm not taking up all the bandwidth.
Okay.
But, okay, the personal issue is that for me as a Christian musician, I got really fed up with the way, like the politics and things of the music industry. And so I decided to come home and use those gifts to serve my local church. And that was about a year ago. And the most I've really done is warm the pews, and just because I guess I operate outside of where the local church that I attend, it's just not really into that style or whatever. I don't really know all the reasons. And so basically when I sat to talk to my pastor, it turned out of a conversation about getting a steady 9-to-5 job instead of a difficult shift in retail. And so the answer never really came from that conversation. And so we've been struggling, my wife and I, because we want to use our gifts, but it just seems irrelevant. And so, like, most of my time has just been spent rather trying to find that steady shift kind of job rather than what I have at home. And I mean, it's just really difficult for a person like me who's really creative to just focus all that energy on trying to get a specific kind of job because my gifts aren't really useful. Does that make any sense?
Oh yeah, I know the problem very well. I mean, I have one of my sons is a musician, and he's got to work regular jobs instead of out performing, and he doesn't have that many opportunities to perform anymore anyway. But he's got to wrestle with that too. And I was a musician when I was younger. I was in a Christian band, and I played Christian concert solo also in the early, in the 70s. And into the early 80s. So I had to deal with all that too. And all that time, I was playing, sometimes our band was playing three times a week in different venues, but we played for free, so it didn't support us, and we all had to hold jobs. But I know you wanted me to talk to you after you said you wanted to get off the line and have me answer, but I can make some responses to that.
Okay. So the real specific area we're having trouble with, my wife and I, is that I could go out to the bars. I could go out to coffee shops in other states and go back on tour. I want to serve at home in my local community, and I feel like that door is just closed. And so I want to be a good Christian and serve my church somehow. But if it's based on my job, I already work my music around my job, and now my job is the problem. It's just a really emotional thing because, like, musicians and jobs don't tend to line up very well anyway. Like, I have a job and I worked very hard at it, but it made no room for my gift. And now the church seems to be closing the door on my gift. And so I'm just
You live in Michigan. Where do you live in Michigan?
Saginaw.
Saginaw? Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, I want to start answering. Do you want to stay on the line? It's okay if you do. I just, you had mentioned wanting to go off, so I'll just want me to try to answer you at this point. I don't mind if you stay on. Yeah. Okay.
No, I should probably hang up so my family can listen with us. Okay. I had another question, but I think I should probably ask that at a different day.
Okay. Thanks for calling,
Shay.
Okay,
thank you.
Okay, bye now. One of the hardest things for musicians is that if they're good, they're pretty much driven to play and write their music and to share it. I mean, obviously, if you're creative and you're creating music, you're creating it in order that, not just so you can listen to yourself play it. You're doing it so that it can have an impact on other people. And if it's Christian music, you're hoping to reach them with the gospel or whatever, with your Christian message. The church would seem to be, one obvious place to play, but your church apparently isn't opening up those doors for you. So what can you do now? Well, I don't know what you can do in Michigan. I know what we did in California. I mean, we did play in churches sometimes. But see, when I was in a band, things were quite different. I can't really assume that you'll have the same opportunities we did, because in Southern California, there was the Jesus Movement, and there were lots of Christian coffee houses everywhere in Southern California, and they all wanted live music. They all wanted live musicians 3 nights a week. And our band was one of the bands that was out there, and there were only a limited number of bands available. So we were booked all the time in coffee houses every weekend, every night. And then there were churches, and there were camps, and there were other things. And sometimes when I had the time, I just took my guitar out on the street corner and sang. And I didn't open my case and ask anyone to put money in. I just sang, or at the park or something like that. Of course, that was the hippie movement. There were people out there. There were street musicians who weren't Christians, too. I mean, I guess there still are street musicians out there. But the point is that if I wanted my music to get out there, I could just go out in a public place if I didn't have, some other booking to get it out there. Now, the music didn't provide any money. Even the coffee houses couldn't afford to pay for the bands that came. So it was a ministry. The coffee houses were not charging anything for what they served. They served free coffee and donuts to people, and they paid their own rent and stuff, and they lived off donations, and the bands lived off donations. So it was not a money-making proposition for anybody, but it was a ministry, and lots of people got saved. It was very satisfying to be in music ministry in those days. Maybe there's some ways that maybe you can find Christian coffee houses somewhere. There aren't as many as there used to be. Find open mic situations in certain clubs or coffee house venues that, there are open mic nights and stuff. And now, see, I don't know, maybe you play in a band rather than solo. If you can play solo, you're a lot more flexible, of course. And I assume since you write music that you probably can do that and do that. But as far as support, for the first 12 years of my ministry, in fact, the entire time that I was in music ministry, I had to work a job, a real job, and had to pay my bills and support my family through ordinary work. And it was always irksome as somebody who really wanted to get out there and get the gospel out to people through music and other means to have to just be putting in 8 hours a day or a good portion of my day doing a job that didn't seem to have any impact on that and seemed to keep me from it. And I changed jobs from time to time. I never really had what we'd call a career. It was always something that I did on the side to support myself in the ministry, though sometimes, I was doing a lot more hours at work than at the ministry. In my mind, I was in the ministry and working to support the ministry and my family. Now, I just point out this, that Jesus, when he was born to be the Savior of the world. And he spent 3 or 3.5 years of his ministry actually teaching and certainly using his gifts in public. The first 30 years of his life, he worked with wood. As far as we know, he never preached a sermon in his first 30 years. He never went out on an itinerary. He never did public ministry at all. And just imagine how irksome that must have, he must have been tempted to be when he's working there on a chair or an ox yoke. And, you know, he's just smoothing a piece of wood. And he's realizing, you know, this is another year gone by, and I'm still here in the carpenter shop. I'm just doing ordinary work. And I'm the savior of the world. And I'm going to have, you know, very limited time to use my gifts to bless humanity. I'm going to have to teach, and I'm going to have to preach, and I'm going to have to work miracles, and I'm going to have to die and rise from the dead, if he knew that already at that time. I don't know. But the point is, he knew he had a bigger calling than just to make sure that people had tables and chairs in their homes. And that's all he worked at for 30 of his 33 years. And I've always thought about that when I had to work at a regular job, because I've always felt called to ministry. But I've also known that Jesus was called to ministry, but God actually required him to work at a real job for 10/11 of his lifetime. I just have to imagine how frustrating that would have been at times for him to realize, wow, the world's going to hell in a handbasket, and here I am, you know, putting another layer of lacquer on this piece of wood here. But you see, the fact that God made Jesus spend 10/11 of his lifetime doing a trade rather than his all-important ministry, really, would suggest that God has lessons for us to learn in the ordinary world of manual labor and making a living and dealing with customers and things like that. And so everything can be part of our training. And by the way, Jesus still, though he was 30 years old before he went into his ministry and only had 3.5 years left, he still did more in those 3.5 years and accomplished more than any other human being who's ever lived. So if you're doing what God has you doing right now, and you're thinking, man, I really need to be doing my music more. I need to be getting out there with this message. God's giving me all these great songs and no one's hearing them. I would just say you got to be patient. As long as there's a need for food on the table and there isn't an opening for full-time ministry, it's appropriate to work at a regular job and do the ministry on the side. Or maybe there might even be seasons where you can't do any ministry on the side. One of the most frustrating times of my life was, I think it was about between 1978 and 80. There's about 18 months there where I was working at a regular job. And I'd been in the ministry for, a decade before that. But for some reason, there just were no ministry opportunities during that 18 months. And I wanted ministry opportunities. But instead, I worked at a full-time job every minute, wishing I could be back in the ministry again. It wasn't clear to me why it wasn't happening. There just was no, where I was living, there was just no opportunity. Now, at the end of that time, another opportunity arose, and I left that job and went into full-time ministry. But, I know what it's like to be not only not ministering full-time, but to want to be ministering full-time and not be doing any ministry at all for a season. It's just not fun when you feel burdened to reach people with the gifts God's given you. At the same time, looking back from my present venue, I can see that I've spent decades in unbroken full-time ministry, though when I was young, I wasn't sure that it ever really become full-time again after a certain point. So you don't know what God has in mind, but you do know that what he wants and has in mind for you is to be very faithful in the thing he has you doing now. And if he's not opening doors for the ministry that you have a vision for, then it may be that the vision God has for it is further out in your future. And that being patient and meeting obligations and so forth in the meantime is how you be faithful to him now, as Jesus had to in the carpenter shop for all those years. I know musicians sometimes, because having been a musician myself and having many, many friends who are Christian musicians, I know the mind of a musician, that a creative person feels like he's really wasting his time if he's just working at a cash register or something, or on an assembly line, or doing some ordinary work. And many musicians are prima donnas about that. They feel like, you know, I'm above that kind of work. But if anyone felt they could be above that kind of work, it'd be Jesus. You know, he was certainly above that kind of work. But he humbled himself and became a servant and did his Father's will in that matter for 30 years. And then, of course, even though he only had 3.5 years left, it was dynamite. You know, it was the most powerful 3.5 years in any human life. And while, you know, you might have, if you have to work till you're 30 or older, and maybe you're already beyond that, but if you have to work a long time more than you want to in a regular job because you're eager to get about your ministry, you might even, once you get into the ministry full time, you might have more than 3.5 years left of your life, and you might have tremendous impact. You'll have, at least if you're on God's timetable, you won't be running ahead of him and doing stuff that he doesn't want done, like Abraham going into Hagar and getting Ishmael when God wanted Isaac. You don't want to go ahead of God and create something yourself that's not of the Lord, even though it seems like it's what, you know, God would want. He wants you to support your family at this point, apparently, and he'll have your ministry open up. Now, at the same time, we do live in a time where a musician has a lot more options than I had in my day, because there was no internet when I was young. And there's, what, SoundCloud and these other things. I don't even know what they are. But I know lots of, you know, musicians put their stuff up on the internet, and they've got thousands of, you know, fans who find them. And so, you know, at least that's one possibility. You, even if you're working a full-time job, if you can put any of your music down and record it and put it up on the website, you'll be reaching some people. You might be reaching a lot of people. In fact, you might, through a mere, you know, YouTube video of music, you might reach more every day than I reached in my whole career in music, because I had to play in venues to be heard. Anyway, those are just some thoughts, and I'm not saying that those aren't thoughts that have already crossed your mind. Maybe you're looking for something more profound than that. But those are the thoughts that occur to me as I hear your question, and I certainly can relate with I can sympathize with your frustration about it. But I believe that God, you have to always leave God the option to set the timing. And that's really all I can say probably at this point on that. So Stephen from Richmond, California is our next caller. Stephen, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for taking my call, and I really appreciate all that you do. I'll try and make this quick because I'm a first-time caller to any show, so I'll try not to mess it up.
I'm flattered that you called here first.
You may not be after I'm finished.
Go ahead.
One of the things in your intro is how to think about the Bible, and I need some assistance in thinking about the Bible. And I've written this all out, so I didn't step on my tongue. G.K. Chesterton says, it's not that Christianity has been tried and found wanting. It has been found difficult and left untried.
That's right.
I have been studying the Bible for a little while now, and I find many prescriptions and suggestions, ideas and orders, I feel they're orders, to help us live according to the Bible and Jesus and God. And as I go through it, I'm getting quite a list. And I've got chapter and verse, but I'll just mention some of them. I'm sure you know it much better than I, because I'm trying to listen for God's still small voice. We have numerous instances where it says, pray ceaselessly, where in Psalms 1, 2, it says, he meditates day and night on the law of the Lord. It tells us to always be patient, to wait, to watch and pray, to always give thanks, and in Philippians 4, 4, to always rejoice. That's quite a list, and there's a lot of always. So it's not just trying to maintain all these things simultaneously. It's trying to find the time to do it, to concentrate on it. And frankly, if I'm doing anything else, for instance, I love novels and I love some adventure movies, I feel a little guilty when I do those things that I'm not praying ceaselessly. So if you could address this in some way, and perhaps this is a false guilt, perhaps I'm misunderstanding something, but I'm really trying to follow this, and it seems quite difficult.
Well, most of the things that you named that the Bible says we should do constantly are attitudes more than actions, to be rejoicing, to have no anxiety, you know, to trust God always and so forth. These are attitudes that can always be present in any kind of activity. Now, praying without ceasing, I realize praying is doing something. And if you really are doing that thing, it takes your attention. I mean, you can't, if you're praying without thinking about it, you're probably not really praying effectively. I mean, thoughtless prayers certainly are not of any great value. You need to be intentionally praying and focusing and trusting God and so forth when you're praying. So if you do that all the time, literally 24/7, you'll never sleep, because you can't go to sleep, because you'd cease praying then, you see. So if you're supposed to pray without ceasing, you're not allowed to do anything that would stop you from praying, including sleep. So, I mean, you could die real young trying to take that absolutely literally. What I take it to mean is that you should pray without ceasing, that is, without giving up. If you're praying for something, let's say you're praying, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, and you prayed it yesterday, and you prayed it today, and you're not seeing it. You're not seeing it happen. Well, don't cease to pray. Keep praying it. Jesus put it this way, or actually it's spoken of about Jesus in Luke chapter 18, verse 1, that Jesus told a parable that men ought to pray always and not lose heart. That is, you don't give up on your prayers. It doesn't mean that every waking moment you are in fact praying. There's other responsibilities that Christians have besides that. But to say, when Paul said to the Romans in Romans chapter 1, I pray for you without ceasing, he doesn't mean that they were at every moment the persons he was praying for. He had other churches to pray for too, and other things to pray for, and, you know, other things to occupy his mind. How could he be preaching out on the square and be praying for the Romans at the same time? I mean, it'd be rather distracting from what he's supposed to be thinking about when he's preaching. So it seems to me, when he says to pray without ceasing, what it means is you're praying for something that you need to keep praying for it, and don't stop. Don't cease praying for it. It doesn't mean you don't ever take a break to do something else or to sleep or anything like that, but it means that you're not giving up on praying for something just because it hasn't come yet. We're supposed to have, persistent praying. So, for example, there are people I've been praying for years who are, you know, having a hard time, or they're away from the Lord or something, and they've been on my prayer list for years, and I'm not seeing the complete answer to my prayers in the lives of many of them, and so I have to keep praying for them. I need to not cease to pray for them. So to pray without ceasing, I don't think means around the clock, every day. I think it means you don't give up on your prayers for these people. But most of the things that are always, give thanks always. Well, I mean, that doesn't mean every breath you take has to be exhaled with the words thank you or thank God. I mean, it means that you need to have your heart be a thankful heart and be rejoicing and be trusting and do all those things. This is a constant frame of mind, as opposed to something you do once a week when you go to church or on special occasions. In other words, he's saying these are not just religious actions that you do on religious occasions. These are things you do all the time. But all the time doesn't mean 24/7 without a break. It means that this is your steady and constant attitude. That's what I think. Anyway, you've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are, of course, a listener-supported ministry. We pay for the time on the radio. If you'd like to help us keep paying for the time, which will allow us to keep broadcasting on the radio, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can do so from our website, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.